I'm Mark Bayshore, its current state. China's economic and political growth has been well documented. However, little attention has been paid to how rapid development has impacted cultural life in China. Organizations in both China and the U.S. are working together to preserve the country's heritage and build cultural ties. Kurt Dewhurst is the former president of the American Folklore Society, and he's the director of arts and cultural initiatives at MSU. Under his leadership, the American Folklore Society started the China-U.S. Forum on Intangible Cultural Heritage. In a conversation with WKAR's Emmanuel Berry, Dewhurst described some of the changes facing Chinese culture.
I think many of us know about the economic changes going on in China, and certainly the changes that we think about politically that we read about in the news. But we certainly don't pay enough attention, I think, to the diverse cultural traditions of China and what's really happening not only to the tangible culture of China, meaning the historical buildings and cities and towns and how they're evolving. But this whole intensification of change and experience is having a dramatic impact on the cultural life of China. China has 55 ethnic minority groups, very deep and powerful, persistent cultural traditions that are being uprooted dramatically now by the movement of people, by the remaking of neighborhoods and cities with the economic explosion that we're all witnessing in China today.
Now, you were president of the American Folklore Society when they started the China-U.S. Forum on Intangible Cultural Heritage. So explain a little bit about what this forum is and what the goals are with this forum.
It was a response, if you will, by the scholarly community of people who study intangible cultural heritage. And the American Folklore Society, much like the Chinese Folklore Society, have spent their professional time documenting and recording the living traditions of China and making sure that they're not only documented, but they're preserved and archived and made available for future generations, but also taking steps to perpetuate them. So whether it's in festival formats or performances. And so for many people who work in that realm, they were seeing how rapidly these were all disappearing or coming under threat, because it wasn't just a matter of escalation of economics that changed things, but it literally meant relocation of people or occupations needing to go to work in other places. And so there was a real feeling that we ought to be taking some steps to, and maybe in a real dramatic way, to do the documentation and preservation and maybe making broader China aware of the depth and richness of cultural life in China and the creative life in China.
Why is it important that the U.S. is involved in that, that this is kind of a cross-cultural thing?
It is really an interesting kind of pairing, if you will. I think that part of this grew out of the fact that we have a number of scholars in the West and certainly in the United States who have had a long time interest in China. So they were aware of these changes and frankly, in some cases, alarmed by the changes. So they felt the sense of urgency. One of the things that the American Folklore Society was able to bring to this conversation, and we're learning from one another. It's not as if the U.S. is bringing new approaches that perhaps might not have emerged. We're learning from our Chinese colleagues too, but they're particularly interested in a lot of the digital and technological tools we're using to document, preserve, and digital repositories where you can record and make available and accessible to scholars around the world the traditions of China in ways that haven't been done. And so in future generations, this period of time that is a period of great change, we will save as much as we can so that we can look back and better understand it in the years ahead.
So what role is Michigan playing in this, and what role do you see MSU playing in building this cultural bridge?
Well, I think I think MSU can be a cultural bridge, and it's doing that in lots of ways. I mean, many of your listeners probably would know this already, but if not, they might be surprised to know that we have almost 4,000 Chinese students now at MSU. That's right, 4,000 students.
Yeah.
They're enriching the experience for all students at MSU. It's happened very very dramatically, really, for us. And so I think that we're learning about China through our Chinese students, but also we need to be able to find ways in which that all Americans can learn more about China. So some of the kinds of things that are going on right now are we're doing a variety of activities at MSU. We have an organization, a group on campus called the Cultural Engagement Council, which includes all the cultural units from the Broad Art Museum to the MSU Museum to art departments, the music college and Residential College of Arts and Humanities, the College of Arts and Letters, and others. We're all working together to have a whole year, a thematic year, of looking at China. So there'll be lots of cultural experiences and programs, including an exhibition that we're working on that I'm a part of. We developed an exhibit, interestingly enough, first with support of the U.S. ambassador to China, and he wanted to have an exhibition of American quilts come to China because he was very interested in quilts and thought about them metaphorically as a kind of patchwork coming together as China is and America is. So the MSU Museum worked with Arts Midwest and South Arts in the United States to put together an exhibition. And this exhibition is touring 6 cities in China right now. It finishes up in Beijing at the new Chinese National Museum of Women and Families, which has just opened in 2010. Beautiful new museum. There's a book. The exhibit is called More Than the Sum of Its Parts. And as a result of that, the Chinese came back to us and said, well, we want to send to America an exhibition of Chinese quilts and textiles. So we're now working on that with the Michigan State University Museum has a partnership with the Yunnan Nationalities Museum, which is in Kunming, which is the capital city of Yunnan province.
Now, at the top, we talked about, we always talk about economics and diplomacy. Why is culture just an important thing to build a relationship on and to exchange, if not more important?
Yeah, I think one of the clear lessons is to say, it comes around the issue of I suppose one could say about diplomacy and more broadly defined, a lot of the struggles we're even having economically to find understanding come from the fact that we don't understand each other's culture and how we do business and how we communicate with each other. But I think it's even bigger than that. The last time I was in China, I was watching the national television network, the CCTV, mm-hmm. And they had a week-long series they were doing on what they called the crisis of creativity in China. And it was very interesting because it was almost the opposite of the dialogue we were having in the United States. In China, they're very proud of their success in science and technology and math and engineering, STEM. If mm-hmm. we're all hearing a lot about STEM in our schools and policies being driven that way. But they feel that the reason they're not competing, they won't be able to compete, is that they don't pay enough attention to creativity. And that grows out of an understanding of arts and culture and a deeper sense of what it means to be a creative thinker. And the kind of regimented way in which education is structured there is something they're trying to counter. So there's actually a pushback in China right now to encourage students to pursue the humanities and social sciences as careers, not just science, math, and engineering, all, mind you, very important fields in the 21st century. But they feel as though what they admire in the United States is we have found more balance in that way. And here we are moving more toward trying to be more like China, perhaps. So I think it's an interesting moment. We have a lot to learn from one another. And while we feel we might have a crisis in science and in engineering here, China is trying to overcome what they perceive this crisis in creativity.
Well, I'm excited to see how this relationship and exchange plays out. Kurt, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was WKAR's Emmanuel Berry with Kurt Dewhurst, former president of the American Folklore Society and current director of arts and cultural initiatives at MSU. This week, the Greater Lansing Sports Hall of Fame honors its 2013 inductees. Hall of Fame director Bob Every led WKAR current sports host Al Martin on a recent tour of the hall's Lansing Center facility. We heard part one yesterday on Current State. In this second part of the tour, Al asks Bob Every to reflect on his leadership role.
Did you ever see yourself as taking over this and becoming chairman of this whole thing?
No, I didn't. I started working at Lansing Community College in 1973 as a part-time instructor teaching a boxing class. Mm-hmm. And then in 76, there was a couple positions of opening for full-time staff members and my boss, Walt Lingo, mm-hmm. who was the original founder of the Greater Lansing Area Sports Hall of Fame, hired me full-time. And so as a full-time employee and the Hall of Fame being housed at Lansing Community College, I was involved in the work process of running the banquet and helping Walt put the thing on. I became real aware of what purpose this thing served and was happy to do so. But, you know, as we grew and grew and grew and went farther and farther and farther into the years, something was lacking, you know. And I think probably what was lacking is that we outgrew the area where we were at. It wasn't suitable for what message we were trying to get out anymore. And so we were settled down with the thing, well, do you stay here and then become nobody knows you or nobody knows where you're at, or do you try to, do you want to be reborn again? So we contacted Scott Keith, the executive director, the CEO for the Lansing Center, pitched our idea by him. He was very, very excited about it. And next thing you know, we're gone. You know, we're out of it. Now, it all happened about the same time I lost my job. Right. And I'm sure that people thought that maybe there was some bad blood and that's the reason we moved out of there. But it wasn't at all. We moved out of there because it was time for us to go to someplace else. And what better place to be than here?
Right here.
This is the hub of downtown. I mean, people can walk in and off the street. There are so many conventions, so many outside visitors that we need to have it someplace where they can look at the history without having to go through all the hassles of, first of all, where is it down there? How do I get there? And all this stuff.
Right, exactly.
So we'll go down here a little farther to this next area where you can see up here. Evelyn Johnson here, and you got the Vincent brothers here. You know, Jay and Sammy Vincent. You got Danny Bass here. This thing right up here on the end is really, really cool. I mean, when you take a look, when you take a look at the MSU Hall of Fame, one of the guys of the first class that was inducted was Fred Alderman. Fred won a gold medal in the 1927 Olympic Games, and he was a member of a 4x400 relay team. They broke the world record. And I called around when he was inducted, and this was just a couple years ago. I called around, see, 2012, and I got a hold of his grandson, and you know, to get the information to bring him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And his grandson says, "You know, I got the original singlet that he wore at Michigan State College, and I got the shoes that he wore when he won the gold medal in Amsterdam."
Unbelievable.
And he said, "Would you like them?" I said, "No."
Yeah?
Yeah. Can I drive out and pick them up? He says, "No." He lived in New Jersey. He said, I'll mail them to you.
Oh,
I mean, you
goodness.
Can see the jerseys moth-eaten and stuff. But
even
the spikes, you don't see them real clear here, but we wanted to put them in a place that were going to be relatively safe. We think that's relatively safe. But what a great...
It's unbelievable. Man.
So all these, you know, all these plaques and all these jerseys, they all have a story to tell. And what we're trying to do now is add the little stuff like the little banners, try to tie everything together. We've got some kiosks coming through. Yeah, you've got your, this is the flag that Judy Brown King was awarded when she was, won the silver medal at the Olympic Games. And so all we're trying to do now is get the artifacts in, keep this thing going, and just keep turning this into a must-see place for anybody that comes downtown. And we're thinking, with the ball field over here, mm-hmm. people can come down and get a bite to eat early before the game, walk through here. If they ever get a casino downtown, that's even going to open more of it up. But it's our intention to continually try to improve on this whole thing by trying to get these types of things here that we can put on display. And I think if you talk about real estate, and you look at this, and then you look at that down there, that's a lot of valuable real estate for the Hall of Fame to tie up.
Without a doubt. Now, Bob, you've told me, I've been doing some research, and you had a quote. Actually, when we talked a few days ago on the radio, you talked about this, and you said, the Lansing Sports Hall of Fame will be my legacy once I'm gone.
Well,
talk about how personal this is for you.
Well, I've been involved, Al, in so many things. I was a boxer. I wanted to be a Major League Baseball player. Good enough to get looked at by the Pirates. I just wasn't good enough to cut the mustard. And, after you get out of your playing days and you think of other things that you can do that you enjoy doing, and sports has always been a huge part of my life. So I started as a boxing coach, and then I had two daughters. I played baseball, summer baseball, and because of my love for baseball, and I boxed and coached boxing. Right. But when I had two daughters, that kind of limited me on the boxing end of it. See, I couldn't just take my son by the hand and go to the gym. Yeah. It was a little bit different taking a daughter over to the gym. So right. They would come to the ballpark. They would see me playing baseball, and they took an interest in ball. And that's how I got. That's how I got there. And with what happened down at Lansing Community College, that's life. I mean, for whatever reason, they think that they wanted to move on and they didn't want me there anymore. I can accept that. I can understand that.
Things happen.
Things happen. But I think now having an opportunity to work with Michigan State Softball Club and be the director of this really has given me a new lease on life, so to speak. I feel like I have value. I feel like what I'm doing is purposeful, and I'll just keep doing that. And if what I do here becomes the legacy of Bob Every, I'm all for that. I don't have any problem with that. I don't care whether people. I just want people to look at me in this community where I've lived all my life as somebody who cares about the community and is willing to do something about it instead of talk about it. I mean, you got talkers and you got doers, and I hope when I go that people say, "Man, God, that guy, he did a lot." All I want is for somebody when they come downtown say, "We got to go to the Hall of Fame. You got to see the Hall of Fame." So
right, definitely. Now, there's another aspect to it that I want to bring up to your attention, man. The Richard Dick Letts Community Award, Community Service Award. Talk a little about that because I feel like that's an important part of sports also. Community service.
I knew Dick Letts personally, and mm-hmm. Dick Letts was he was so many things. Where I knew Dick was is that he was a boxing coach, a volunteer boxing coach for the Lincoln Center, which was at that time over on the west side of Lansing. I think there's still some type of a Lincoln Center over there. But Dick felt that it was his duty to try to influence as many young African Americans to be involved in a wholesome program like amateur boxing as he could get. And he donated literally hours of his time to do that. And then he was also the human relations director for the city of Lansing. So his worth for what he did in his town is unmatched, quite honestly. I mean, he was responsible for a lot of things. So several years ago when Dick died, there was a guy on our board by the name of Ron Reed, who'd since passed away last year. Ron was one of the, if not the first, person asked by Walt Lingo to be on the selection committee back in 1976. And up until a year ago, Ron was on the committee. Mm-hmm. But then he died. He was talking about when Dick died that we needed to do something to honor Dick Letts. So we then put the thing in motion, and the Dick Letts Community Service Award was born.
When you look at the sports, Lansing Sports Hall of Fame, what's the criteria to get on these walls?
Well, first of all, you have to be a Lansing area high school graduate mm-hmm. or have spent 2 years in a Lansing area high school. You have to have participated in sports here if you're not a high school area graduate for 15 years. So like a guy like Al Martin moves into town, Al becomes very very fluid at doing something, and he's here for 15 years, then you could be considered. Even though you didn't graduate from a local area high school, your sport or whatever you do was recognized as being from the Lansing area. So basically that's the criteria there. And then we leave ourselves the opportunity, the selection committee leaves ourselves the opportunity to take a look at any buddy that would submit an application and say he qualifies or he doesn't qualify. There are conditions, you know, that we may allow somebody to come in based on what those conditions are. But basically, you know, this thing is set up for people who are from Lansing, who live in Lansing, who graduate from Lansing, you know, and you know, that's how basically that starts.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, but that's, you know, that's pretty much it. Like I said, we're talking about getting some stand-up kiosk. Now, we want to do more for Magic. You know, Magic doesn't expect it, but he deserves it, you know. I mean, he is Lansing's favorite son. There's no doubt about that. And, you know, we just want him to know how much we appreciate what he's done, not only for the community but in the university, but, you know, for the, you know, for the Hall of Fame by making that huge donation that was so kind of him to do.
Exactly, because, I mean, like I said, I mean, from the outskirts looking on, where I'm from, Detroit, I mean, when you talk about Lansing sports, the first name that pops up, in some people's minds, the only name that pops up is Magic Johnson.
Yeah.
And, you know, definitely that would be great to honor him. I think he really liked that, man.
Well, I went down to the Michigan Sports Hall of Fame not too long ago when Jimiteen Cleaves was inducted. And, you know, I had a chance to sit at the table with a few celebrities and Charlie Sanders, the great
intern. He's one of the most recent inductions.
Yes.
With Steve Smith and Tony Dungy. I was down there to cover a story, actually.
Yeah, I was there, and Charlie Sanders was sitting at my table, and I had a chance to talk to Charlie, and I'm thinking to myself, God, what a great thing they have here, because, you know, that's really a media thing, because you draw some big-time people there. But they don't have any facility.
They don't.
They don't have a facility. I mean, they used to be at Cobo, but now they're not there anymore. And I'm thinking, how could you not have a facility for as many great people?
Wow.
So they're working on trying
to get something that you guys got a leg up in Lansing when it comes to that.
We sure do. And to be quite honest with you, we explored the idea of maybe moving the Michigan Hall of Fame here, but I don't think the people that run it in Detroit want to do that, because it's too far away.
Right.
And it's really kind of a big deal for them down there, and I don't think that the people at the Lansing Center really cared to share their space with this. I think they're perfectly happy with this stuff here. So.
Without a doubt. Well, hey, Bob, thank you so much
for
the time, man.
You're welcome,
I will definitely be taking some of my friends down here to see this, because they have no idea, you know, some of the names that have come from here, man. So
good. I appreciate you guys coming.
Bob Every is the executive director at the Lansing Sports Hall of Fame. For Current State, this is Al Martin.
Stay with us on Current State. Our weekly Neighbors in Action series is up next. Then, back in time at Fort Michilimackinac. The Straits of Mackinac is a traditional favorite for thousands of people traveling to Michigan for the summer. One of the area's top attractions is Fort Michilimackinac, built by French fur traders in the early 1700s and later turned into a British military outpost. Each year, locals reenact the era of colonial Michilimackinac, but 2013 marks an important milestone in its historic legacy. Current State's Kevin Lavery took a trip up north to learn more about the most dramatic event in the fort's history.
The native tribes who lived at the tip of the mitten were the first to see this geographic wonder where two of the five Great Lakes touch. In the 17th century, French fur traders ventured through these waters. By 1715, a crude timber-walled city had arisen on the shore. They called it Michilimackinac, the native word for great turtle. The Jesuits brought Christianity to this New World wilderness, and they established strong trade relations with the tribes. But France and Britain fought for control of these trade routes, and by 1761, the French turned Michilimackinac over to its old enemy. The colonists were allowed to stay and practice their Catholic faith, but the Redcoats made it clear who was in charge.
Ready!
I came to call on the English infantry last Saturday to hear more of the story. At the commander's quarters, I met an officer in full dress who was queuing up for a Memorial Day march. I noticed that he bore a striking resemblance to Craig Wilson, the museum historian from Mackinac State Historic Parks. I could sense all was not well in the empire. Here in the spring of 1763, Wilson told me there was tension among the tribes.
The British government ceased giving gifts to Native American leaders. Gift giving is a very important part of Native American culture. They had come essentially to expect that as part of good relations. The British, as a cost-saving measure, decided not to do that. And that's just one of many, many things. There's widespread suffering in Native communities. There are crop failures. There are famines. There's epidemic disease all happening at the same time. So it's just one thing after another that leads up to this general discontent with this new British rule, who have, they've replaced the French. They're not treating the Native people as well. And the Native people eventually said, we've had enough. And so Michilimackinac is just one of several forts that is attacked during the summer of 1763. On June 2nd, 1763, about 400 Ojibwa men began by playing a game of bagadaway, or as we would call it today, lacrosse, just outside the fort walls. It was a very festive, very sporting atmosphere, but it was actually just a cover for a plan that they had to actually attack and capture Michilimackinac, which they eventually did. They tossed the ball near the gate, which was open. They ran over as if to follow it, and they just kept running. They ran inside. The women who had been watching the game passed out weapons that they had concealed beneath the blankets that they were wearing. So these men, hundreds of them, who are now armed, ran inside the fort and essentially began killing all the British soldiers that they could find. And within a few minutes, they were able to kill about 15 of the soldiers here. They captured the fort, and that's all part of something much larger that we know as Pontiac's Uprising today. Michilimackinac is actually the largest fort to be taken by Native forces during Pontiac's Uprising.
What physically happened after the uprising in terms of the Indian occupation of the fort?
They didn't necessarily occupy it. They had essentially killed nearly all of the British soldiers and taken the few remaining men as prisoners. They didn't stay here and garrison the fort or anything like that. And indeed, the local Odawa were instrumental in actually saving the remaining prisoners. There was some tension, at least if you believe the historic records, between the Odawa and the Ojibwa, who both live here. They both come up here and trade on a regular basis. The Odawa were supposedly unhappy that the Ojibwa had not told them this was going to happen, so they actually took in the remaining prisoners. In the meantime, the commanding officer who survived the attack appointed a man named Charles Langlade, who was one of the very prominent French-Canadian and also Métis residents, so he had both French and Native American parents. He appointed him as a temporary commander, and he actually oversaw the fort for most of the next year.
George III was the King of England at that time, and shortly after Pontiac's uprising, he issued a very famous proclamation. What was that, and why was that significant in colonial America?
It's the Proclamation of 1763. It happens too soon to be a direct result of the uprising, because that's signed just shortly after all this stuff stops happening. What it does is it formally recognizes this vast new territory that Britain had acquired from France. They had been in possession of Canada and most everything west of the Appalachian Mountains for about 2 years at that point, but they had never set up any sort of administrative structure. This finally did that. And it, at least in theory, tried to set up an Indian state. There are maps that specifically say lands reserved for the Indians west of the Appalachian Mountains. And the idea was if they could keep European settlement on the eastern side, they might be able to, you know, maintain good relations with the native people. They might be able to continue trading with them because the native people really are at the core of the fur trade. But as you might imagine, all these settlers out on the East Coast, this is just one, again, of many things that starts to lead to overall discontent with the British.
How is that part of America's history still vital, still relevant? How does it still echo today here in Michigan?
Well, you know, I think it's definitely apparent in places like this where we're trying every day to share that history with our visitors. I know for a fact it's a vital part of Native American communities. We've worked pretty closely with some of our local Native groups, particularly the Odawa, the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa. And I know that this heritage of Pontiac and this this idea of resistance and fighting to preserve their culture and their way of life is still very important. And they can trace that through Pontiac, through the American Revolution, through the War of 1812, all the way really up through modern times. So it is still there. It might not be in the places that you think, but the heritage of the uprising, of the attack, it is still very important.
Craig Wilson is the museum historian at Colonial Fort Michilimackinac, which is observing the 250th anniversary of the attack that was part of Pontiac's rebellion, June 2nd, 1763. Craig, thank you for talking with us today, and I'll let you get back to your official duties for the Crown.
All right, well, thank you.
For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery.
I'm Mark Bayshore, It's Current State. Thank you. Its Current State, I'm Mark Bayshore. For today's Neighbors in Action segment, we feature Lap Respite Center in East Lansing. We've got a couple of guests from the center here today, but before we talk to them, we're going to give you a brief inside look at their organization. Current State's Kevin Lavery visited the center and has this report.
To find the office of Lap Respite Center in East Lansing, you have to drive a bit off the beaten path. It's tucked away in a low-rise brick building on the north side of Valley Court Park, sheltered from the faster pace of life along nearby Grand River Avenue. Here, peace and quiet is not just a perk, it's the point. Among other things, Lap Respite Center runs an in-house adult day program for the chronically ill and disabled. Executive Director John Stauffer says each person here has a behind-the-scenes caregiver who sometimes needs a little care themselves.
So by us taking that person on and coming and enjoying the services and the activities that we have here at ALFA, which stands for Active Living for Adults, we then give the primary care provider time off, quote, respite.
Some of the ALFA participants come just one day a week, others five. Not everyone here today was able to celebrate Easter at home, so the staff sees to it that their holiday does not go unobserved.
They just got done dyeing eggs. They were in here doing that, and now they're out here playing an egg game. So we're going to go out into the main room and see what activity they're working on right now.
No, it is not.
About 15 people are gathered around a very long rectangular table. Their sport of choice? Guess what's in the Easter egg.
What's in there? What do you think is in there? Shake it and listen to that. What could be in there?
While the game is underway, Stauffer takes me aside to show me a tray of cupcakes. Treats are a mainstay here, but this is a special occasion. Joe, a gentleman sitting at the end of the table, is turning 96 today. He's officially their oldest member.
And he's not really proud to have that title. He personally would rather be a little younger if you ask him. but he's happy to be here and happy to be with us.
Okay. How about we have Joe open it up to see what it is?
30 years ago, LAP Respite Care started off simply as LAP, Lansing Area Parents. Local families looking for resources to support their disabled children couldn't find any, so they started their own. Today, Stauffer is encouraged that government is becoming more sensitive to the emotional well-being of providers. But giving care to caregivers is an idea that comes from the grassroots.
I can only hope that as a society we learn the value of caring for each other, and that by the time I reach Joe's age of 96, that there will be somebody there to be able to give the kind of services that we've given to him.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And here with us now in the Current State studio to tell us more about Lap Respite Center is Executive Director John Stauffer. Hi, John.
Good morning, Mark.
And he is joined by Nancy Gettler, who's been taking her son to Lap Respite Center for nearly 20 years. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there.
John, tell us a little bit more about Lap Respite Center. I understand you have an interesting beginning.
We certainly do. When people hear the word respite, they aren't always quite sure what that means. And in its simplest term, respite simply means short break. And there were a group of families in the Lansing area that had children with an assorted types of disabilities, and they needed that short break. And they band together trying to find resources for care for their children. They looked at the federal level, they looked at the state level, they looked at the local level. They were simply unable to find a pool of money or help from an organization, state or federally. So what they did was they started helping each other. They simply came together and said, well, if you'll watch my child on Tuesday so I can go to a parent-teacher conference, then I'll watch your child on Saturday so you can go to the soccer game with your other children. And they literally did that for 4 or 5 years. At that point, they were able to land a fairly substantial federal grant, and that allowed them to bring on an executive director, Judy Wagner, and she was their executive director for 22 and a half years. She helped grow this organization. and they were able to become a 501c3 nonprofit. And at that time, they changed their name from Lansing Area Parents Respite Center simply to LAP Respite Center.
There has been growing awareness, it seems to me, of this notion of giving caregivers a break. But it sounds like, do you feel like you were at the cutting edge of this idea?
Absolutely, Mark. I think that back in the 70s and 80s, this was just starting to come about. And it truly is a grassroots effort. The government's just starting to understand the implications of families and the dynamics of what happens when you're having to care for someone who needs 24/7 care, mm-hmm. and the impact that that makes on the community, the impact that makes on that family when a mom has to stay home from work because she's got to care for somebody 24/7.
Nancy Gettler, you've been taking your son to LAP for nearly 20 years. Tell us about him. Tell us about your experience at LAP.
Well, we're transplanted here from the Chicago area. Well, actually from Minneapolis by way of Chicago area. But when we came here, we had an 8-year-old son with cerebral palsy, severely brain damaged, two required, lots of physical care and a wheelchair and feeding and those kind of needs. And I was looking for somebody that could just help me out for those very reasons that John said, school conferences, maybe taking a bike ride with my other children, maybe a short overnight trip somewhere. And I was given the name of LAP, and it was just a godsend, and I've been with them ever since. And that has progressed to weekends. We have a respite house where we can take our son for a weekend. So that recently I had to go see my aging mother, and I used to take him along with me, but can't anymore. So that provided me an opportunity to leave town for the weekend. And my son enjoys those weekends. He's with kids his own age or other, there's lots of activities going on that are fun, and it allows me great peace of mind because I could not have a neighbor or a relative come in and take care of him for
You're a member of that generation that worries about their parents and their kids.
Yes, I am.
Right, there's a lot of us out there
yes.
right now. Tell us a little bit more here about your experience raising your son, though. How many kids do you have?
I have three.
Three.
And he's the oldest.
Okay.
So, and, you know, you get so used to it that you don't even realize that it's different. But for years, my husband and I, and still really only go out one at a time, one person at a time, to different events because our son is difficult to take along. Now, when he was little, it wasn't so difficult, but now it requires a van and a lift, and the wheelchair is big and doesn't go places easily, and special feedings. And although we love him and he's delightful and it's wonderful taking care of him, just having those little brief respites makes it so much easier.
I am sure. John, how do people find you? How do they get connected to LAP?
Well, I'm working hard on that right now, Mark, but one of the best ways to find us is through our website, which is simply laprespitecenter.org. We're in the Senior Preferences Guide that is posted in a lot of community buildings across a Tri-County area. You can also contact us directly. We're in the phone book, so 372-6671. You can call. Most of the people who use our services sometimes come to us indirectly through either Tri-County Office on Aging when we're working with our senior population, or through community mental health most of the times when we're working with our children. But we're happy to have them contact us directly. They can call us. But the best thing, I love the internet, that Googling is easy. If you Google LAP Respite Center, you'll find us.
What is one of the more, from your perspective with the organization, is there a memorable encounter that comes to mind?
We get touched daily. I have the most wonderful job in the world in that I get to oversee a bunch of professional, trained individuals who are passionate and compassionate and tender and understanding, that go into these families and allow them to operate as well as they can as a family unit. And it's just a wonderful experience to be able to hear those care providers come and share with me stories and events that have happened. I think probably the best story that I can think of right now is a story of a young man whose mom thought that he would never be able to feed himself. And our care providers, because we're there a lot with them and have the time to do that, were able to work with him over a course of several months and get him to first hang on to something, because first whenever anything went to his hand, he would just throw it. And he learned to hang on to something. Well, what do you normally feed somebody? A Cheerio or a Fruit Loop, something like that? Once he gets that, like a baby, where does that go once it gets into the hand and it stays there? First place it goes is right into the mouth. So once we got him to hang on to his hand, we were able to get him to take that from his hand to his mouth. And then we were able to get him to actually hang on to like a spoon. So we've actually, over the last 6 months, the first 6 months that I was actually here at Lap Respite Center, was one of the most touching stories to me, because we were able to do something for that family and for that mom that she thought was never going to happen. Mm.
And she saw it happen. Yes. It unfolded. You rely heavily on volunteers?
Not so much, because our training is so specific that we have to do, because of the disabilities that we're dealing with, because of the illnesses that we're dealing with. We can use volunteers at the adult daycare program, because that's a group setting. But a lot of our work is done one-on-one with these families and these individuals, and without some specific training, volunteers are not probably the best use for the causes of what we do.
Nancy Gettler, is there a bond among parents of special needs children? I imagine there is.
Oh, yes. We all, you know, feel each other's pain, sort of, but and share the information we have about LAP and share the information that we have about whatever services are available, but there really is a bond, and there's a bond with the workers, too, the care providers that come into our house that really, truly know how to take care of our children, put a whole new spin on care, because you get sort of used to your mundane, everyday tasks, and when you have somebody new and enthusiastic come in the house, it gives you a bright, fresh look at your child. It makes you refreshed, and, you know, oh, gee, he really is kind of a fun guy to hang out with, you know.
John, how do people get involved with the organization, and what kinds of folks are you looking for?
That's great. And just a quick follow-up, Mark, on what you said, where it came to me as I was talking. One of the ways where we could use a volunteer is if you have somebody that we're touching their heart with the story that we're telling here, if they have a skill set, if they were an artist, if they're a musician, we could have them come to our respite house and entertain the children that are staying there for the weekend. They couldn't provide the care, but they could certainly enhance their life in that weekend. So if there was somebody who wanted to contact us that had a skill set that they would like to share with the folks we work with, that would be awesome.
Right.
As far as reaching us and those folks who tend to work with us, about 70% of our care providers are Michigan State students. They have to go through it's a 3-day full 8-hour day course, some on-the-job training at our respite house in our after-school program, and they also have to do on-the-job training in the home usually. Nancy's son, for instance, needs some specific kind of care. We would not have somebody work with that child until she's had the chance to work with them to make sure they understand what they're supposed to be doing.
John Stauffer is the executive director of LAP Respite Center. Nancy Gettler's been using LAP to care for her son for nearly 20 years. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
That's Current State for today. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Gary Reed is WKAR's Director of Broadcasting. The show is engineered by Aaron Young and produced by Joe Lindstroth. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.